Okay, so it's late. You haven't slept in over a day, but if you drift off, your alien duplicate is gonna mine your psyche for all your memories and personality. So you're looking for some coffee to keep you awake a little longer. But you're not gonna drink just anything. I mean, you've got standards. What are you, a pod person? You're not gonna settle for anything less than Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug coffee is made from premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-caf for those of you who already got a dose of Dr. Bonnell's speed. But best of all, Sparkplug delivers this phenomenal coffee right to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug even offers autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So, plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
We're here already. Our podcast is next. Or maybe it's right now. Hiya, classic movie lovers, and thanks a pile for downloading the Next 100 Project, the weekly podcast that delves into films from many years ago. If you don't dig on spoilers, you might want to watch this flick before we wreck everything about it. I am that small-town doctor with extremely justified paranoia, Ryan Ellis, and seated with me on the couch is my stunning co-star in this venture, my wife Bev.
That's me.
Okay, that's you. Let's talk about the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the 1956 edition. So playing off the idea that this movie was remade in 1978, and other times too, but that one especially, the Donald Sutherland version, name your favorite movie remake.
I had a short list, but I did settle on a favorite. My short list includes the new version of Hairspray, which is a remake of a great John Waters film.
One of my favorite musicals ever is that version of Hairspray.
And has a genuinely fresh take. You could completely individually appreciate both films. I really like the David Fincher version of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I don't know if it counts if it's a remake of a foreign film. Yeah, okay. Oh, great. That opens up the door to lots of films. The Thing also.
Yeah,
that's a great one. But my number one, Coen's True Grit.
That's your favorite of all time. That's a good one, though. Definitely a good one.
What's yours, sir?
I have a short list. Those are all good choices. I don't dislike any of them. Here we go. Maltese Falcon, which was remade a few times, including the one that we like so much, but it was done before the 1941 Bogart version we like.
What?
Talked about that on that podcast.
Oh, yeah. The 41 version. That was a remake?
I think it was called The Devil Makes a Lady or Satan Makes a Lady or something like that.
Okay.
The Magnificent Seven was a remake of a movie we're going to cover very soon, The Seven Samurai. The Thing, you said that one. The Fly.
Yeah, that's a great one.
And I think that's a better movie than
definitely,
the original one.
Yeah, Cronenberg.
Maybe Cronenberg's very best film. If not his number one, it's one of his top three. 12 Monkeys is a remake of a short film called La Jetée, and I love 12 Monkeys, as I've said on this podcast many times. And then the 1978 Invasion of the Body Snatchers is also on my short list. If I had to pick one of those movies as the best one, it's Maltese Falcon. But my favorite one, the one I watch over and over again, would probably be 12 Monkeys.
Okay.
But the only one we had that overlapped was The Thing, and I think most people now think that movie is brilliant, but of course in 1982, we didn't like it so much. It was actually a big failure. And John Carpenter, who was recently on Marin's podcast, talked about how that really hurt him. He thought it was his best film, and yet it did not do well.
Lots of people have a lot of love for that movie now.
There's a good chance we'll cover that next year because it will be the, 35th anniversary? Yeah, I think The Thing will make its way into there, and people will probably like hearing us talk about that because if they like our podcast, they probably like The Thing. Pretty good combination of things there. Anyway, good remakes. There's a ton more we didn't even mention. And you mentioned foreign films that became American films. The Departed.
Yeah, The Departed is a good one.
Mentioned too. But we could do this all day, so let's move on.
Yeah.
The Next 100 Project's 25th movie, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, was nominated for the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. The picture was released a little over 60 years ago by Allied Artists in February 1956. Made on a small budget, Invasion earned a solid chunk of $50. But Bev, explain the movie to people who aren't really familiar with it anymore, or maybe they never were, with the skinny.
The fictional town of Santa Mira, California, is quietly overrun with alien pod people. Kevin McCarthy is Dr. Miles Bonnell, and his lady love Becky is played by Dana Winter. They and some of their friends fight to stay awake and stay alive as the pods replace humans with eerily similar imposters.
Or, in a nutshell, whatever you do, don't fall asleep. Nightmare on Elm Street, another remake.
Oh, right.
Well, the original that we all like so much wasn't a remake, but the 2010 version. Remakes, that'll be a recurring theme in this podcast, won't it? Okay, Rotten Tomatoes numbers. 98% of critics liked the movie, 48 fresh, just one rotten, and 85% of audiences. And I looked up the numbers of the remake before we sat down. Very similar, about 95 or so of critics and 85, 86, something like that, of audiences. So right in line with each other. But what does Bev think of Invasion of the Body Snatchers 1956 edition?
I loved it. The concept is so uniquely troubling, and the film draws it out so nice and slowly, but when it comes time for action, it feels surprisingly modern. It definitely transcends its low budget and feels way fresher than it should for a 60-year-old film.
They don't waste much time. It's a quick in and a quick out. But I will say this, 1 hour and 20 minute movie should even be shorter. And I recommend this to anybody who's never seen the film but happens to be listening to us anyway, and they probably shouldn't because this is a very spoilable movie. Don't watch the opening or the ending where Miles is saved.
You know what's funny is a lot of the reviews kept talking about its phenomenal ending. And they're talking about the scene on the highway when he says,
You're next.
And looks in the camera. That was supposed to be the ending. Mm-hmm. Everybody who hasn't seen this movie in a while just completely forgets the bookends because it's so obvious that they were shoehorned in there after the fact.
The studio insisted.
Just couldn't tolerate the bleak ending. They couldn't tolerate the cynicism of it. Which is a shame because I think the movie definitely would have been better. It would have been better if it just started cold with him driving back to town without
the... Which is what it was when they shot it originally.
Yeah, and definitely would have been much more impactful if it had just ended with him staring at the camera saying, you're next.
And also it gives away the fact that he survives if he's going to run out there. Unless you maybe could make the argument that he's just faking this. But then can the aliens fake emotion? That's one of the whole themes in this movie. Dana Winter blows their cover by yelling when a dog's about to be run over. She's got emotions. And that ruins it for them. Nearly gets them killed. Well, it does get her killed. Or maybe not killed, but turned into a pod person.
My one major problem with this film is
the inconsistency with the pod thing.
It's really a problem. Like, I'm surprised more people don't complain about this. Because I've been thinking about the movie so much. It's so good and it's so smart. But every time I think about it, I really get stuck on that point. Why were they even bothering running? And why was anybody chasing them? Because you know they're eventually going to fall asleep. And if that's all it takes for them to be won over by the pod people, then who cares? Why would you chase them?
Yeah, because early on, they are alien pods. Just like a big giant pea pod.
Yeah, and why would you even be growing people in pods if it's a takeover of the body that already exists?
Because that's what Dana Winter has happened to her. There's no pod there. It certainly wasn't planted there for her. You can't make that argument because they weren't supposed to be there. But then suddenly she's just, Miles, everything is great. Join me, join me.
And she's already fallen asleep in a house with her copy in it.
That's another thing. Her father, I guess it was, yeah.
Well, yeah, the alien that took over her father, I suppose.
That's one of the things about this movie. There's a lot of subtext. Any good horror movie, any good sci-fi movie, and this is both, I suppose, has got a lot of subtext. And Republicans must love this one because it's the paranoia. Don't trust your neighbors. Don't even trust your father. And you certainly can't even trust your lover or your would-be lover in the case of Winter and McCarthy in this movie.
Apparently, right-wing people would see the movie and think it was all a big metaphor for communism.
Yep.
That it was communism taking over the towns and all the friends and neighbors. But then liberals would see the film and interpret it as McCarthyism and Eisenhower-esque conformity.
And the filmmakers insist that neither of those things were intended.
They were just trying to make a cool movie and they wanted to make it about paranoia. And I think, regardless of what you think the subtext is or how you would like to interpret it, the concept of not being able to trust your friends and neighbors, the concept of something being just a little bit off. And it's not just with body snatcher movies. It's the same sort of theme that you might see in popular modern movies like The Matrix or The Truman Show, where it's just that notion that we all probably suspect sometimes that the world that we see around us can't be trusted.
And you're the only one that isn't in on it.
Yeah, and to prey on that paranoia, there's not a lot of films that pull it off well, but when they do, there's just something about that that gets so far under your skin and into this little niggling suspicion that we all have.
I think that's one of the things people are really showing in the modern era on social media, that feeling that I'm all alone or my opinions don't count or you're all different than me, but I'm going to insist that this is what's really the truth. I've got this microphone. I'm going to say, well, not literally a microphone, typing on the keyboard, but I'm going to say all these things and you're next if you don't join me kind of idea.
But then it's funny because social media can give you an echo chamber as well. So then people are just alarmed to discover that there's this whole pocket of people they never hear from who've been in their own echo chamber. You get all these people who are alarmed to discover that all these Americans are happily voting for Trump and supporting all of his ideals that disgust and horrify a lot of left-wing, bleeding-heart liberals like ourselves.
Or even a lot of Republicans
who are
supposed to side with his values, but they don't side with his values.
Yeah, and it seems like, how have you all been hiding in plain sight? There is this nature of society that we put on a patina and pretend to be perfect small-town America. And you say the film wastes no time. I don't think that it wastes any time, but it does spend the whole first act really devoted to illustrating what a perfect, ideal little American town this was.
Well, yes, but right away they get into the what they call the capgras. I think I'm saying that right. C-A-P-G-R-A-S. Delusion. And that is something that's real. It has nothing to do with just this movie. Exact doubles of people you care about with no emotion or humanity. And the first one that he comes across, I believe, is a mother and a son,
yeah,
is it not?
Or it's a father grandmother, or aunt, or something.
Something like that, right.
Son's
that's not my grandmother. But of course it's your grandmother. But then in this case of the story, that's not the truth. But people really feel this way in reality. And I think that's where this idea maybe come from, too. It was Jack Finney's 1954 article in Collier's that started all this whole thing. And then Daniel Mainwaring, I guess is how you say his name, Hollywood writer, adapted that. So I guess you gotta give Finney credit for coming up with the idea of let's take this capgras delusion thing and then turn it into a movie as this idea that you can't trust anybody, but it starts innocently enough with a kid or a woman. Hey, let's face it, this is the 50s. Women don't count the same way as men, especially a doctor like Miles.
She's hysterical,
but
right?
Once Miles starts reacting this way, then of course his superior is probably 20 years older than him. Well, you're just joining all these people who are irrational, Miles. You're just wrong and they're wrong. But before that happens, just a kid, just a woman, well, what do they know?
Yeah. But in the first 20, 30 minutes of the film, these are just these little niggling problems in an otherwise really idyllic town where everybody knows their neighbor and the doctor is friends with everybody. Although they're wise not to make Miles perfect.
Coming back from Reno after getting a divorce.
Yeah, taking a trip to Reno is a euphemism for getting a divorce. And Becky, oh, I went to Reno four months ago. And so they're kind of sharing that. And that is this imperfection, because I don't think that you could make the film the same way if he was Jimmy Stewart. If he was perfect 50s character, that really wholesome guy. He had to have some flaws, because the whole point of the film is people should be allowed to have their flaws. Mm-hmm. When they're trying to seduce Becky and Miles to just join the pod people without fighting, they're saying life is better without emotions. There's no violence without emotions. The world is going to be a better place once we finish taking over and eliminating the flaws of humanity. And it's their flaws that they want to keep. So he couldn't be perfect. He couldn't be too sanitized.
And as we've said to each other many times, not on microphone so much, but in a free society, people unfortunately have to have the right to do bad things.
And they certainly should have the right to end a bad marriage, to, you know, pick the wrong person and make mistakes.
Mm-hmm. These two aren't cheating on anybody, and that's interesting. They don't really have a bona fide love affair. It looks like it's going to go down in that direction. But they are exes from, I guess, high school. They used to date. So now it's this idea of, well, now we can make this work. So it's even more insidious at the very ending when she's the one who's saying, come on, make it good for you kind of deal. In the remake, Donald Sutherland's girlfriend is naked. And of course, you couldn't show nudity in 1956. So it's even more that deal where she's saying, come join me. And in both shots, as I recall, they're in a field. No one else is around but the hero of the movie, who's now all alone because the one last person he could trust has turned against him too. So on that one, it's even more blatant. Join us and come. Have your way with me, because here I am for you. Yeah. And speaking of Dana Winter, the heroine of the story, at least for most of it, when they show her in close-up, she is perfect. She's gorgeous. Elizabeth Taylor is thought of as the great beauty of this era. I think she's prettier than Elizabeth Taylor.
And that dress. I want that dress with the poofy boobs. It's such a great dress.
She worked for a long time, 40-plus years. I guess her biggest hit apart from this would be Airport. I didn't see a lot of other titles that were all that impressive, but man, what a fox. And then Carolyn Jones, the other girl in the movie, the other woman in the movie, I should say. Best known roles, of course, The Addams Family. She's the original Morticia, long before Angelica Houston, who was perfectly cast, probably even better than Carolyn Jones when they did the movie version.
One of the compromises that they had to make with the film with their low budget is they had to hire nobodies. You know, these were newcomers. They weren't famous at all. But one of the things that Siegel does, I mean, he overcomes his...
We didn't say his name, Don Siegel.
Don Siegel, the director.
The guy who did Dirty Harry.
Yeah, and he's really, really overcomes that low budget. But one of the things that low-budget movies fall prey to all the time is crappy acting, and that is not a problem in this film. The actors are great. They're really convincing. I really loved it. It doesn't distract at all. You know, I think about Carnival of Souls, which you and I watched not too long ago, a very low-budget horror film, and the acting is just terrible. perhaps they used the budget for the effects that they used in that film, which were kind of...
They had much less budget. That movie was made by all nobodies. The director, no one even knew who he was. He made industrial films before that.
Oh, okay. Because I find, like, that's always a dead giveaway when something has a terrible
budget. That movie
is
beloved because of the atmospherics and for the twist ending, which is... You guessed it. You've seen so many movies, you maybe wouldn't have guessed it if we'd seen it 20 or 30 years ago. That movie's not ever going to be thought of for its acting. It's all about the fact that it's this idea of she was dead all along. And then, yes, the creepy atmosphere where she's seeing all these ghouls.
The style.
That wasn't quite done in Hollywood movies at that point. Not very often, at least. Just like this movie was original for its time. The whole thing about pod people, Don Siegel, he seemed to think every executive was a pod person. None of them have emotions. None of them have feelings. They're all just bastards. And then he hated the fact they imposed that opening and closing on him. Oh, another subtext, by the way, on this one. I think this is also a stand-in, the whole story it is, for getting high and not dealing with complex life issues. You don't have to feel anything. Why do people take hardcore drugs? I mean, even the drugs we've got sitting beside us right now, booze. But especially if you're going to do heroin or something really, truly serious, you don't want to feel anything.
Yeah, because the criticism of the film, even though Siegel will deny that he's taking the sides of the communists or McCarthy, the film is definitely criticizing conformity and that lackadaisical lack of caring that people lose investment in life.
The Matrix plays on that, too.
Yeah, that everybody just wants to be sheep and just stop paying attention to anything. You know, pod people are the uninformed citizens who blindly trust their leadership to take care of everything for them. That could be the drug thing, too, that people just say, oh, screw it, and they get high and they don't really pay attention to what's going on around them. They have no investment.
Because they want to be numb. I think the other insidious moment in the film for the Kevin McCarthy character, for Miles, of course, Dana Winter is the worst moment for him, but his best friend early on, King Donovan, the guy who plays him, he was in The Defiant Ones a couple of years after this. Damn good film, we should watch that one time. A little too on the nose, maybe, with Tony Curtis and Sidney Poitier about the racial relations, but a good film that he was in. But when he comes into Miles' office with a guy they already know is on the bad side, and he's now saying, Miles, come on, just relent. That's a good setup, because when his best friend says it, your heart's pulled out of your chest.
Yeah, you're sad. He's a cool character. You like him. It's a total bummer when he gets turned.
So it's almost more effective that you see him get turned than when you see the girlfriend get turned. If it had just been her, it might have been more of a twist or a surprise that she doesn't actually make it out with our main character. But when you see the best friend do it first, you're set up for it, and maybe you kind of somewhat expect it. But don't really expect it, because you're going to think, these two beautiful people are going to survive, aren't they? Of course they are. No, they're not.
Maybe another small complaint about the film. Nobody seems to grieve people they've lost. In particular, Becky, who loses her father. There's never a point in the movie where she even makes an expression to convey that she's sad that her father's
likely
dead.
Maybe that's a subtext,
dead.
Too. I mean, that's a deliberate choice. Well, also, talk about emotions. They all take the whole, there's a corpse on the pool table, rather well.
Yes.
When they get called over to the friend's house, Carolyn Jones, King Donovan's house, and they see that body that's his body, or it's becoming at least, no detail, no real stuff there, no details in the face and all that, no fingerprints. They don't really react the way you would think to this thing just being there.
True. I like how Miles is such a cool customer through most of the film, and there is the slow build of him getting more and more frantic. Of course, he's not sleeping and he's taking speed, but the slow build makes such a great payoff when he's gives the best part of his performance, which is him panicking in traffic, the very famous scene, the you're next. The absolute panic on his face is so uncharacteristic for him, but, I mean, who couldn't relate to just the frustrating H-bomb of paranoia that would be going on in this poor man?
There's not much humor in this film. The original cut was funnier, but the studio didn't want to confuse the audience. I don't know why that's confusing, so they cut a lot of the humor out.
It didn't work, I guess.
And ironically, the 1978 remake has quite a lot of weird stuff. And some of it is flat-out funny. One of them is a dog has a person's head on it. It's an effect that works okay in the film. It's kind of bizarre, maybe. But they went for the moon with that, didn't they? And then curious for a sci-fi film. Very cheap effects budget. There aren't that many effects in the movie anyway. But you'd think they would have more invested in that. The Day the Earth Stood Still was 5 years before. Very famous sci-fi film. Linked with this one in a lot of ways. I mean, they're not that similar in tone or theme. But small budget kind of movie. Not a lot of famous actors involved. That one's actually got more production values, I suppose, and a bigger name director, Robert Wise. Siegel was still kind of new to getting into the big time of the business. But that one's got more special effects that would have had to have some kind of budget to make it all work out. And this one, you don't really need effects.
Well, the concept really lends itself to having a low budget. You know, we talked about in our Ghostbusters podcast last week when Dana becomes Gozer, her makeup changes, her hair changes, she looks completely different, but in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, that would totally defeat the point.
Yeah.
The point is that you can't look at them and tell. And actually, as audience member, you know, when Becky and Miles kiss at the end, we can't tell that she's different. We can only tell because Miles can tell and he says so. Every character appears totally the same to the audience. It's only their close friends and family that would notice that anything was wrong with them.
Well, I'm not getting into the Capgras illusion thing, but if you and I were to kiss and there was no emotion behind it, you wouldn't think somebody was possessed or have an alien inside of them, but you'd wonder, what's wrong? That would be your first instinct. What did she do or what did I do in this day that's caused them to be in a bad mood at the moment? But if you know somebody well enough, you're going to know something's wrong by a handshake or a hug or a kiss not being what it was the other times you handshaked, hugged, or kissed them.
That's true. If something was weird about you, my first assumption would be that you were mad at me or that you were upset about something. I guess the movie just decided to skip that step because they wanted to get right to the point. I mean, another thing with low-budget films, it was a B-film, really. They've got to be short. Apparently, 80 minutes was even a pretty long running time for a movie of this nature.
It should have been shorter because they shouldn't have had that beginning.
Yes.
Or the ending. B-film or not, there's some suggestive scenes early on. Very sexually suggestive, actually, for the 50s, between Miles and Becky. Isn't it the King Donovan character that comes over and ruins it for him? Come over and stay with us tonight because of that corpse thing on the pool table. Oh, I don't get to sleep with my girlfriend then, do I?
And they've both been married, so you don't have to be quite as chaste. I guess we can make assumptions about how fast their relationship might move.
They don't say it openly, but that seems to be his problem, is that he wanted to spend some really personal time, and he didn't get to. So getting back to the themes of the film, there's a loss of humanity that was evident in the 20th century as that century wore on. This was only 10 years after World War II. And as time went on and people saw the horrible things that would happen, not just when everyone was saved by the Allies, rescuing people in Europe and Japan, things just seemed to get worse as that century wore on in a lot of ways. There were worse centuries for bloodshed. Apparently the 20th century was not even the worst 100 years in the history of the world for deaths and violence and all that kind of stuff. But maybe we just all seem to lose our perspective on a lot of this kind of thing. The Korean War happened around the same time as this, I guess a little before this. We talked about McCarthyism, America being terrified about communism. A lot of things were in the future. We didn't know that Vietnam was coming. We didn't know that the Iraq wars were coming. We didn't know terrorism the way it is now was coming.
There was a threat of atomic warfare.
That's right. That was always looming over there, sure. That's why there's this terrifying fear of Russia, because if we ever get into a war, America gets into a war, both sides have nukes, and we're all dead.
And there must be a certain amount of cognitive dissonance if you are a war vet, if you saw any of the kind of violence and real horror that took place overseas, and then you come home to America and everyone's like, okay, now tighten up your tie and go to work and live in this America where everything
soldier.
Is perfect. Yeah, and they
different
have
kind
this,
of soldier.
Yeah, but there's this real veneer that everything has to be perfect and everything's fine, when there must have been a great deal of people who just couldn't go back to that American way of life.
They had PTSD.
Yeah, and it wasn't even like it was before. It was this whole different kind of perfect nuclear family, small town America that they were expected to fall in line with. That had to be incongruous with how they were feeling.
Women were finally starting to get rights. It wasn't happening yet, I know, but it was going to. And so were people who weren't white, especially black people. That was going to happen soon enough, too. So in other words, the whole world is changing. That's part of the paranoia as well. Certainly that's true in 2016. People are terrified the world's changing on them, or even their neighborhood's changing on them. I don't like this. Oh, no, pod people. No one uses that expression, I know, but that's the same kind of mentality, I guess. As for the pod people and what they do, there's one thing that I don't think really makes sense in their way of doing things. Why are they playing music in the climax? And there's also a more famous version in the remake where it's Amazing Grace that's playing when the main character in both movies comes across this horde of pods that are going to all kinds of other cities that'll take things over. We mentioned The Thing beginning of the film. That's the logic that Wilford Brimley is worried about, that if this thing gets onto the mainland in any country, and he's got a little computer simulation that shows it'll spread here this fast and then here this fast and the whole world in a matter of, I think it's months or maybe it's only even weeks in The Thing. It's the same idea. You get to any other major city. They're not that far from San Francisco. The remake is set in San Francisco. And once you do that, then all bets are off.
As far as the music goes, I thought it was implied somebody just accidentally left a radio playing. But you could also argue that the pod people were trying to lure them out. Oh, look, there's other still old-fashioned humans.
Oh, not just our two main characters, but any other people
sure,
who are
yeah.
be left behind.
Oh, there's someone else who hasn't been taken over yet.
I think the best answer is it's just cinematic and they liked it.
Sure, yeah.
And it's very true about
just
the remake.
Just give an excuse to separate them.
Because Amazing Grace is a great choice for something that is such an apocalyptic sci-fi horror film. But if the plant people are going to take over, I, for one, bow to our flora overlords. One more theme I want to get to before we get into the behind-the-scenes people. Of course, the line, wake up, is in this film. That's a Spike Lee thing. His is about racism. Wake up, America. Well, the same deal here. If you want to believe the movie's about communism or about McCarthyism, wake up to what's going on in America. Then, more so than now. We're talking 60 years. McCarthyism is long gone. But then again, there are things in its place instead. Now it's about, you weren't really born here, President Obama. Let's get you. So Joe McCarthy lives on in some kind of ways, actually. We mentioned the other actors. We didn't really talk about the main star of the movie, the one person who goes from start to finish in the film, Kevin McCarthy, who worked for nearly 70 years. He was in Death of a Salesman in 1951. There's been a lot of versions of that one, but he was, I guess, Biff. He was, of course, in the 78 remake, still running around telling everybody, you're next! Then he dies in that movie. I think somebody shoots him or something like that. And his more recent career, the last maybe 20 or 30 years, he worked with Joe Dante a ton, the guy who did Gremlins and Inner Space and Matinee and a lot of other interesting B-films. He was another guy who was on Marin recently. Well, that was the same podcast, actually, as John Carpenter. So Don Siegel did Dirty Harry and a lot of other flicks with Eastwood. I know you liked his direction because you brought it up a lot in the podcast, but here you go. Microphone's yours. Don Siegel behind the bullhorn on this one.
Top points for difficulty because the low budget and a concept that could so easily have been stupid. There's lots of things in the movie that are kind of dumb, like the pods look like cheap light paper mache, or just the whole concept in general could have fallen apart so easily, but he really nailed it. And with the studio intervening and no money and not the cast that he wanted.
It always helps when the actors seem to believe it.
Yeah.
If they believe it, then we can too. We don't always, but it's better for us to believe if they do. I didn't mention a future director who is on camera in this movie and is also a dialogue coach and did that job a lot for Siegel back in this era. Sam Peckinpah.
Yeah, it was his protege.
He has a cameo in the basement. He's the meter reader. You never recognize him. I had to point him out to you because I thought it was fun to say, hey, that's the guy who becomes a much bigger name as a director than Siegel, who was a good director in his own right and made some big-time movies like Dirty Harry. Now, as for the Daniel Mainwaring screenplay, one thing I did not like at all was the unnecessary voiceover. They tell you things twice. They show it, and then they say it. Or they say it, and then they show it.
I've seen far worse offenders than this. Oh, for
sure. Yes, but I didn't like that part. And then the producer, Walter Wanger, was his company that made the movie, actually. The movie is 200:1, so that's 200:1, and it's Super Scope. We've never seen that before. I don't think any movie we've covered so far. But that was also against Siegel's wishes. He would rather the movie had just been the normal aspect ratio, or even still at that point, a lot of movies were 4:3, the Academy ratio that people were still using because widescreen was still quite new in 56. We did watch the DVD. It's also been colorized. We saw the black and white version, so stick with that because he wants to see a colorized version of a movie that should be black and white.
Yeah.
Cinematographer Ellsworth Fredericks shot 7 days in May in 64 with a lot of big-name actors. That was a John Frankenheimer production. And he operated the camera on one of my favorites, and I think it's one of yours too, Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Robert Eisen was the cutter, did the big combo. Not a lot of other notable flicks in his resume, but editing.
Editor, oh, yeah.
You liking it?
Everything about it. I mean, it's 80 minutes long, so kudos, sir. Nothing feels left out, and nothing feels superfluous.
Yeah, all right. Composer was Carmen Dragon, who won an Oscar for Cover Girl, and this was his last movie. But typical for a 50s sci-fi slash horror movie, the music is repetitive. It's not quite Black Lagoon-esque where you hear the thing over and over. And also a short movie a couple years before, Creature from the Black Lagoon. But you do hear the same theme, maybe a little bit too often. So unlike for Ghostbusters last week, which didn't have that much influence that we could come up with, this one's got a lot. You got the equally creepy sequel, Body Snatchers, that's all it's called, Body Snatchers, in 1993, and The Invasion, Nicole Kidman and Daniel Craig in 2007, all have the same storyline as this picture. I mentioned Joe Dante did Gremlins. Well, the pods that hatch Mogwai into Gremlins has got to be an influence from this movie. And the other influences I've got are more the lines from the film. The phrase pod people started from this picture, or I guess it was Jack Finney's article in Collier's, but that became a more common thing. People still use that phrase even now. Frankenstein's line, it's alive, it's alive! Probably deliberate reference to the movie from 25 years earlier, Frankenstein. And then the horror movie, You're Next, probably wasn't based on this movie exactly, but that is the famous line from this picture, which was nominated for the top 100 quotes. They're here already, you're next! But didn't make it. And speaking of AFI references and awards and such, no Oscar nominations, made the National Film Registry in 1994, along with huge titles, The African Queen, The Apartment, E.T., The Manchurian Candidate, one of our favorites, Midnight Cowboy, Pinocchio, and Taxi Driver, and all but Pinocchio and Invasion of the Body Snatchers are AFI films from that group. The AFI lists 47th in the top 100 thrills, and it was 9th in the sci-fi category of the top 100 genres. And that, as I've said many times, is probably my favorite of those 10 genres. because, for one thing, it represents all kinds of different types of movies. This is the one low-budget one of those 10 that has got a very original premise. Well, the other ones have original premises, and this is the one that stands out the most, I think, from a low-key standpoint. This movie is quite low-key, considering the fact that at the end, the main character is hysterical. All right, well, last thoughts on Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Kudos to Siegel for taking what could have been a ridiculous idea and making it seem terrifyingly plausible.
Agreed.
And for making a film that's aged this exceptionally well, 60 years later, it does not feel like it's from the 50s.
Now, before we go, we talked about this a few days ago. You know about the end of the remake, right?
Yeah,
the last
yeah.
shot. You've seen it somewhere, but you never actually saw the whole movie.
Close enough. I've had it described to me many times.
Okay. That is one of the great last shots of any movie. And a great twist, too. And I'll give it away now that Donald Sutherland has been taken over at the very end. We think maybe he survives. But logically, in both movies, when you fall asleep, you become these pod people. Again, there's no pod when the woman in both movies becomes one of them. And then in the remake, when our main character becomes one of them, they just are, which is so inconsistent. But it's a great twist that somebody else managed to survive. Veronica Cartwright in that one, who's still human. And then... great last shot. Okay, the next time you press play on the next Winter Project, we've got Audrey Hepburn playing a classy call girl in Breakfast at Tiffany's. The coming attraction trivia for Breakfast at Tiffany's, which you've not seen, right?
I've never seen it.
And I saw it so long ago that it might as well be fresh for me. Although I've done the research now, so I've been reminded of the story. Anyway, name the other three women besides Audrey Hepburn to win the competitive EGOT.
Oh.
Competitive because there have been two or three women who've been given honorary awards.
Yeah, okay. I think I know who one is off the top of my head, but I will save it for next week. So for the answer to that question, please tune into next week's podcast. If you'd like more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, please rate us and review us. It helps people find us, and we love that. And while you're there, go ahead and check out one of our many other podcasts. Everything's still up there, and it's still free. Those include all 123 films that ever made the Top 100 AFI lists in 98 or 2007. You can find both Ryan and me on Twitter. I am at BevEllisEllis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. And before we go, we'd like to warmly thank our sponsor, SparkplugCoffee.com.
Well, it's mid-July, and it's really hot in here. I don't know about you, but I'm too hot to be a pod person. I think I'll just stay being a human.
Agreed. Do pod people feel heat? Because it's about 40 degrees in this room right now. Do they sweat?
Oh, if they don't, then okay, I'll be
a pod person. I'm down. Let's go to sleep right now. And...